Hello and welcome to The Mock Review with Ben and Drew. I'm Ben Garmo.
And I'm Drew Evans.
Well, Drew, we are officially into the summer. We're recording this in July, which for many people is a quieter time for mock trial. But we've got a lot of exciting things going on in our community. I had the privilege recently of coaching at Trial by Combat. It's the fourth year in a row I've gotten a chance to coach at that competition. It was just really a wonderful opportunity to be able to be there. And we'll have a different episode coming out before too long to talk about that competition, to talk about the results. Obviously, Ben Crosby of Patrick Henry was crowned as the 2022 Trial by Combat champion. We'll definitely be discussing that at length. But before we get into any of that, and of course, today's episode, which is all about the AMPTA board meeting, which we're going to get to in our second segment, we actually have a really exciting podcast-related announcement that we want to talk about. We don't usually spend much time at all on the podcast talking about the podcast itself. And, you know, that's for a reason. We know that, like, Inside Baseball probably isn't what you all are tuning into the podcast to hear.
It's the podcast within the podcast.
Right, exactly. It's like the meta podcast or whatever. But we have something really exciting that we're looking forward to talking with all of you about. So, Drew, how have things been going with you? And what are you thinking about what we're about to reveal on the show today?
Yeah, so first of all, I mean, I think it's still kind of crazy to me just how long we have been doing this podcast. Yeah. I think that when, like, way back when Ben and I initially started discussing it, I feel like it was something where I was like, oh yeah, like, I'll do this while I'm still in the mock trial in college. And at that point, you know, nobody, I don't think even you know this, Ben. At that point, I thought I was going to be working at Six Flags once I graduated. I thought I was going to be done with mock trial. I was like, yeah, see you later. But, you know, here I am, and I'm still doing it, and Ben's still around, and we're loving it. So it's definitely cool, and I think this is going to be kind of the next evolution, I'm hoping, of the podcast. So I'm really excited about it. But yeah, I mean, there's been a lot of really exciting stuff going on. Trial by Combat was obviously amazing. So many interesting things happened there. Can't wait to talk about that. But honestly, like, I'm burning to let them know about this, Ben. So I'll give it back to you if you want to tell them what it is that we've been talking about and working on and finally excited to announce.
Yeah. So as Drew mentioned, we've been doing this podcast for a little while. This is actually about to be our fifth year doing this podcast. And as Drew said, when we started it out, it was just kind of something that we were trying out to see what we thought. And we're really fortunate to have gotten support to keep going. But as we go into our fifth year of podcasting, we really want to bring the show to another level. And we want to bring you more consistent content. We know that we don't really have a schedule for when the episodes come out. The episodes, especially during key periods of time each year, sometimes come out a little late. So we are announcing today that we are launching a Patreon. And we are specifically launching our Patreon with the goal of hiring an editor. Now, if you're not familiar with it, Patreon is a platform where creators like Drew and I on the show can interact with people who listen to or consume their content. And while there is a way for you to follow for free, which we're going to get into, you do have the ability to pay for that content. Our Patreon is going to be at patreon.com/themockreview. If you're hearing this episode, it means that the Patreon is live. And we're going to talk about this in more detail in just a second, but the specific reason that we're launching this Patreon is with the goal of hiring an editor so that someone else besides me is the one who's editing the show.
And listen, we want to be really clear. We do not make any money on this show. In fact, both of us have spent hundreds of dollars of our own money, which is fine. We weren't in this to make money, and we still aren't now. This is really to allow us to both buy an editor, you know, to hopefully pay them for what we find to be very important and meaningful work, but to actually pay them for their services as they should be. If we're going to try to up the pace and if we're going to try to release episodes every other week, which we want to do, we're going to need some help with that. And our hope is that in doing so, it's going to give us some more consistency with which we upload and give out that content to all of you. It's really important to understand this, guys. Like, we are really not doing this with the hopes of, like, making this some sort of cash cow for us. I don't think either of us think it will be that, nor do either of us think we need that. It's really just we want to break even. And if we want to pay someone what we think is a fair amount for fairly difficult work, what we need of that. And to be really clear about this, we are going to be as transparent as we can be about it. We don't want anyone to think that this is for any means other than just us breaking even and us paying someone for their work. We're specifically hoping to start releasing episodes every other week starting this fall once the season kind of starts to kick off and we start getting more content going. And our hope is that we can continue that pace, you know, until the end of time. Ben has been, you know, taking the lead on the Patreon, so I'm going to throw it back to him to explain the different levels that we're going to have on our Patreon.
Yeah, and as Drew just mentioned, we're working on getting this ready so that when the season really gets going, this is something that we're able to do and to bring you all really regular content. So our Patreon is going to have three categories to launch. The first one is you can follow the Patreon for free. We want to make sure that anyone who wants to join this community is welcome to do so for free. And if that's all you want to do, fantastic. Done. We're thrilled to have you. If you feel like you're able to support financially, we've got two tiers that you can do, $2 and $5. We don't really ever intend to do anything more than that. We want this to be as manageable as possible. All three of those categories will give you access to our Discord server. So we're not charging anything to join that community. If you want to do one of the paid tiers, we've got some small benefits. They're not, you know, we're not going to send you like a giant swag bag or anything like that. We've got some small benefits like monthly Zoom calls and maybe a mention on the show sometimes. But we don't want to overcommit ourselves, but we do want to provide some meaningful benefits. Drew was right that I've been taking the lead on the Patreon, but Drew's been taking the lead on the Discord, which I'm really excited about. So Drew, can you tell our listeners a little bit more about how the Discord is going to work?
Sure. So the first thing I want to reiterate is that the Discord is completely free. We do not believe in charging people for talking about mock trial. Obviously, that's something that all of you already do. But our hope is that this is a way to kind of engage with the community on a little bit more of an individual level and also provide a place to talk about mock trial a little bit more freestyle, kind of just conversationally. One of the things that I've always felt about mock trial is that your options are fairly limited. Whether it's mock trial confessions or impeachments, those are not always the most conducive to having just a quick conversation. I'm really hopeful that this Discord can be something where people can come from all over, can discuss mock trial, whether with us or with each other, and can just become that forum space for people that isn't kind of as formal as an actual forum. I also want to be clear, I am well aware that there are at least two other Discords, to my knowledge, that already exist. We don't mean to be stepping on toes. I more than welcome people to join those other Discords. The only reason why we're doing our own separate one is that we didn't want to kind of jump into one and take it over and say, hey, we're going to be here. We wanted to make our own. That way, people that listen to the podcast, that want to get podcast-specific content, in addition to talking about mock trial, would have a place for that. We're optimistic that we can post announcements on this Discord, let you know what to be expecting, what's going to be coming. We're also going to be doing lots of little things on there. Maybe we'll ask people for their thoughts. Maybe we'll hopefully get your ideas as far as who to be on the lookout for, what teams we should be looking for. All those little things that we kind of get criticized for before, we're hoping to try to address by engaging more with all of you through this Discord. So again, it is completely free, and I really, really hope you guys join it. All you have to do is sign up for the Patreon page. To be clear, you do not need to subscribe to either of the paid levels. Just by adding yourself to the Patreon page, it will give us access to your email. We will then send you the Discord link, and then you will join the Discord.
Yeah, and I'll echo that. I'm really excited about this because, you know, I'm sure like many of you, something happens in the mock trial community and I end up texting with a variety of people mm-hmm. about it and saying, oh,
I'm
this
one
is...
of them.
Right, yeah, Drew and I, you know, I'll be like, Drew, did you see this? And he'll be like, yeah, I did. And we talk about it. I want to have those conversations on a more broad level. I've met a lot of the people who listen to the show when I get to travel to competitions. So I'm going to be really active in the Discord. I know Drew will be mm-hmm. as well. Hopefully not in class, but other times. You know, we'll be really active in there. One other thought before we sort of wrap up this segment. I want to be sort of as honest as possible with you all. Drew and I have been discussing this for a few months, thinking about the future of the podcast. and we're hesitant to do it because let's be real here. I'm sure many of you have dealt with this in your programs or other things. Asking people for money is not fun. And you have to put yourself out there by your very nature of doing it. You have to say, we think we're creating something or doing something that's worth even a small amount of your money. But just to be totally honest with you all, if I have to keep editing every one of these shows, I'm not sure how much longer the podcast can last. This past year, for example, our Orcs week two episode came out after Nationals. It wasn't because I wasn't trying to edit the episode, but I was preparing a team for Nationals and I just didn't have the time and mental energy to get it done. And the problem with that, of course, is the busiest times of year for mock trial, when you all are most looking for mock trial content, are the busiest times of year for me. So I can't keep editing every show, which is why we want to hire an editor. Like Drew said, we're going to try to break even, but we're never going to make any money from this show. We don't put a single penny from the show in our pockets. We spend our own money right now. We're going to keep doing that. And if you're willing to contribute just a little bit to help us out and help us get onto those consistent schedules that we were talking about, we would be really, really grateful. So Drew, can you kind of wrap us up here a little bit and give them sort of the last bit of details before we finish up this segment?
Sure. Just to kind of reiterate this, and we don't want to belabor it, but we do think it's really important to be clear. Like, this isn't about making money, but we really didn't want to go the route of trying to, I don't know, get advertisements or a sponsorship or something like that. That just didn't really feel like the brand that we've been going for. And to be totally honest, it's not actually that lucrative with just the small group that we have, which is totally fine. Like, we're happy with it. But I think that at least in my view, and I think Ben will agree that a lot of the point of this is, you know, we hope that on some level people understand that we've been doing this out of the goodness of our hearts, and that's why we do it. That's why we continue to do it, and we're more than happy to. But we're hopeful that people will want to support us in that way and help us to just break even. And that's really the point of this. I'm going to be honest. I'm not sitting here and saying that, you know, the $5 level is, you know, $5 worth of content every month. It's about hopefully for you all showing your support of us. And that's why we want to recognize and do some little things for you guys to say thanks. But that's really the point of all of this stuff. But if you have any other questions, please, please, please email us at themockreview@gmail.com, or you can reach out to either of us directly on Facebook or whatever other platform you want to use. You know, hell, if you want to just bash us in mock trial confessions for it, go for it, and maybe we'll break our vow of silence and respond in the comments. But honestly, like I said, we're really, really excited about this because we want to give you more regular content. We want to engage with you more. We want to respond to all of the things that people have been saying they want to hear more about. And we're hopeful that this is the best way to do it moving forward. So Ben, I'm going to throw it back to you just really quickly before we get into the board meeting. Let them know what we got.
Yeah. So like Drew said, ads were not something we really ever wanted to do. This segment is not brought to you by HelloFresh. you know, like I tried it during the pandemic. I'm sure many of you did as well. I don't think they would be interested in advertising with us either way. But like Drew said, we're really excited. Candidly, we've got a lot of stuff that we've wanted to do for a long time, and just having to try to work around our schedules and me editing the episodes and just the constraints we're working under right now, we haven't been able to do that. This is going to allow us to do that, to get on a regular schedule. And so any support that you're willing to offer, even if it is just joining the Discord and just being a follower of the Patreon without doing either of the paid tiers, fantastic. We'll be so grateful for you for doing that, for joining our community and helping us to build the show up for the future. So thank you so much for giving us a few minutes to hear us out about this. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to be right back to talk about the board meeting. As I'm sure many of you are aware, there is a ton of stuff on the agenda for the board meeting. I will be there in San Diego next weekend for that meeting. And so we're going to go through and give you a preview of what to expect about that meeting. So hang tight. We will be right back after this break to talk about the board meeting. Welcome back to The Mock Review. Thanks, everyone, for bearing with us as we went through our exciting new announcement about our Patreon. As we mentioned earlier, our Patreon is at patreon.com/themockreview. One last thought on that as we transition into talking about the board meeting. As I mentioned in our previous segment, I'm going to be there. The board meeting this year is in sunny San Diego. And as I think I've mentioned on the show before, it's going to be tough going to San Diego. Why? But I will make sacrifices for this show. In all seriousness, I will be there. I'm looking forward to sitting in on some of the meetings and the main board discussion. And of course, our Discord will be active. If you're hearing this, it's active now. So I'll be posting on there. And if you have a specific question that you want me to answer about what's going on, I'll be keeping an eye on that and doing my best to stay engaged with the community at the board meeting. So if you're looking for a reason, even just to sign up for the free option, maybe the fact that I'll be at the board meeting and we'll probably be one of a pretty small number of non-board members there could be a reason why you might want to jump on. But enough about the Patreon. Drew, we have got a lot to discuss.
Oh, yeah.
There is a ton on the agenda. I have some initial thoughts before we get into some of the individual motions.
So do I.
Yeah, I thought that you might. So how about I'll kick it over to you. Give me your thoughts. I'll go to mine and then we can start talking through all of these motions.
All right. So I will start by saying that when I opened the, I believe it is 42-page board meeting agenda, I was a little intimidated at first. And I hope to all of our listeners, if you were a little bit intimidated by it, I hope that does not discourage you from listening to the best of this. We're going to do our best to kind of briefly explain what's going on, what is potentially going to change, and we'll at the end kind of explain that a lot of the stuff at the end is not going to happen, essentially, but we'll kind of explain what all that is. But I'll just start by saying that I basically think what has happened is for a while now we've been having this struggle between the board and the rest of the AMPTA community on what invention of fact is. And the board has finally been like, screw it, we're just going to change the rules and make it so that everyone understands them and it's super clear, but it's going to mean that we're kind of killing a lot of the creative things that people have been doing in the past. Maybe some people really like that. Maybe some people really don't like that. I'm going to spare my very specific opinions about different aspects of them for when we get to it, but I will give that as the preview for everyone. And I will just say that I really, really hope, and you're probably going to hear Ben and I say this at least 3 or 4 times each, but I really, really hope the board takes a lot of time to do some outreach and to explain all of this to everyone, because while I would love to think that everyone listens to the podcast and that we are able to provide enough info about what is going on and what changes, I'm realistic about the fact that there are 700 some odd teams that participate in mock trial, and there are definitely not one member of every single team that listens to this podcast or that follows the board meeting. And that means that there are teams that are going to be left in the dark and are going to be very surprised next year when the rules feel very, very different. So I really hope there's a lot of outreach that happens. I hope that there's a lot of efforts made to ensure that everyone understands and knows what is going on. But we're going to try to do our part. Please, you know, as much as other board meetings, I have said it is an important episode to listen to. I think this may be the most important one yet. This has probably the most ramifications for mock trial as an activity as any board meeting I can remember in recent history. I don't know about you, Ben, but that's my take on this. So I'll throw it back to you.
Yeah, I pretty much agree with all of that. And my thoughts will echo that a little bit. So let me first say, because I don't know if any of you are playing like mock review, board meeting preview, bingo, but I'll give you your free space. This meeting should be live streamed. The live stream should be recorded. The live stream should be available for anyone to watch at any time. The fact that it isn't, I have spoken to people about why that is. I've yet to hear a reason that I believe to be compelling or sufficient. If there's something being discussed that people believe is not for public consumption, it can be moved to executive session, or maybe it shouldn't be said at all. It should be live streamed. I think it's common sense. I don't understand why it hasn't happened. So totally agree with you, Drew. Ton of big changes that are going to happen, that are likely going to happen, that may very well be passed. as you'll hear throughout this discussion, I agree with the vast majority of them. I think there are some fantastic things that are being proposed here. Here's my issue with the process. So we have this ad hoc invention committee that was formed a couple of years ago and has sent out some surveys to engage with the community, which I think is great. Other than that, they've been operating largely in silence. And, you know, we really haven't heard anything as the broader community about their work until we see all of these motions, which have been discussed in committee and recommended to the board. So now, about 2 weeks before the board meeting, the agenda drops. And as you said, Drew, it contains massive updates, huge changes to almost every aspect of the way this activity works. Now, I've been to 3 of these board meetings in person and also watched the one on Zoom. And I think my biggest concern is that I can tell you from experience now, the board-wide meeting, which happens in the afternoon, is usually maybe 4 or 5 hours long. It's where these things are discussed and debated in the open, but it is not where anyone forms their position or decides where to vote. The overwhelming majority of the discussion and debate and decisions are made behind closed doors in email threads and other conversations that happen well before the board meeting. There are almost 40 people on the board. There's just no way that all of this could be fully discussed and debated and fleshed out in the small amount of time, relatively speaking, that the board has for public consumption. I don't know if any of this is going to pass or not, but what I do feel confident saying is that it's very unlikely that anything that's said at this quasi-public meeting will change the preconceived notions that most people feel about these motions. And to the notion that this board meeting is public, it is public in name only, in the fact that the vast majority of the public discussion that is going to happen will be open in the sense that it's going to happen at a meeting that is paywalled to 99% of the AMTA community. I joked about the fact that the board meeting is in San Diego. Yeah, it's going to be nice to go to San Diego in July. I'm going to spend thousands of dollars on this trip. I'm fortunate that I'm able to do that. Many, in fact, most people likely are not or are not willing to do that, and they should not have to. So I want to separate this out. I am not criticizing the board for these motions. I am not criticizing the board for the process they're going through for making these motions. I think the vast majority of them are fantastic. But we have got to have an honest conversation about how we communicate in this organization, because these are huge changes that are being discussed and debated and should not be adopted until the community has more opportunity than a week and a half with an email address that candidly not a ton of people pay attention to. We've got to do better than that. I hope that we can provide some information, like you said, Drew. And I'm happy to move us to the first one. But first, I want to kick it back to you if you have any thoughts based on what I was just saying.
You know, it's funny, as you were saying at the very beginning about your, whether it's mock review episode or just board meeting bingo, I'm sitting there and I'm like, man, that would be a really cool thing for us to do if it was live streamed and we could do it on our Discord. So I was just thinking, like, that would be a really fun activity.
Hey, I'm with that.
I know, but I mean, it's not live streamed, but maybe you can be our narrator. Seriously, I agree with everything that Ben said. I think that there are certainly a few things that I was not fully on board about, but I agree with Ben that it's probably going to happen anyway, and there's not going to honestly be a whole lot of discussion about it. And I do think that actually the vast majority of them are net good purely from the perspective of clarifying things. And I just think that, you know, it is definitely in my mind changing what the mock trial was that I did, and probably changing the mock trial that my predecessors did. But I think that in the importance of trying to get everyone on the same page, that is what I see this as. And I think that that is a very, very good thing. But in order to get everyone on the same page, you got to make sure that everyone knows about it. So going back to Ben's point and my point, this is the second time, so you can double mark it on your bingo board, but they need to make this public, to let people know as much as possible about it, and to make sure that teams understand the rules that have changed, because it is going to be pretty big. But as we've been talking about them, I think let's go ahead and get into it. Probably the one that we're going to have the most debate on, or maybe just the most criticisms of. Ben, why don't you take us to Invention of Fact 1?
Sounds good. This is what I think is likely the largest rule, and like Drew said, probably the one that will generate the most controversy. So INV-01, and by the way, when we're referring to INV, that's referring to the Invention Rules Ad Hoc Committee, which was a committee that was formed, I believe, by Brandon Harper. It may have been at the end of the Warahei administration or the beginning of the Harper administration. It was somewhere in there, but it's been a couple of years, and it's an Invention Rules Ad Hoc Committee. INV-01 is a motion to replace the reasonable inference standard with a necessary inference standard. I'm not going to read the whole proposal. You should go to AMTA's website and read it, but I will read the definition and a little bit of the rationale. So the definition says, the rule book shall use this definition. A necessary inference is a fact or opinion that must be true given the facts stated in the witness's affidavit. An inference is not necessary merely because it is possible, merely because it is consistent with the witness's affidavit, or merely because it is reasonable or plausible. Example, if a witness's affidavit says they are a graduate student obtaining a PhD, it is a necessary inference that when they obtained that they obtained a bachelor's degree. However, it is not a necessary inference that they went to school for 4 years or majored in the same subject in which they are now seeking a doctorate. So just a little bit, I'm not going to read the whole rationale, but the rationale basically says that AMTA has an educational mission to have students advocate persuasively within the facts, not to invent new ones. And basically they say that the reasonable inference rule doesn't work because it's not as restrictive as AMTA intends. It's confusing. And the only remedy, impeachment, is not consistently effective because judges just don't recognize it. Mm-hmm. And the rule is too open to dispute. And as it says here, it says, based on our surveys, we know that even AMTA directors have very different understandings of the reasonable inference standard, which I think many people could have told you even before you, you know, if you've sat around a table with any AMTA directors. So a few brief thoughts. This is obviously an enormous change. The necessary inference rule is very common at the law school level, where I do a lot of my work now. And, you know, Justin Bernstein, I think, leads the Invention Ad Hoc Committee. I think there are other people on the committee who have ties to law school mock trial. I am guessing that some degree of this comes from the law school mock trial world. I'm torn on this. It feels to me like a bit of an overcorrection to a legitimate problem. And my biggest concern has to do with witnesses. I think that if we're going to do this, number one, all of my critiques of the process earlier still apply. There needs to be town halls. This needs to be workshopped in invitationals, all of those things. But if we're going to do this, we have to recognize that the way that witnesses work at the undergraduate level is vastly different from the way that witnesses work at the law school level. Witnesses at the law school level are conduits for information. It is very frowned upon to do anything character-based with your witness, and explicitly banned for witnesses to invent anything in any way. And you can get thrown out of tournaments halfway through if they think that you're running what they would call an advocate witness. This is a completely different sport. Law school mock trial and college mock trial have a lot of similarities. They have some massive cavernous differences, and witnesses is one of them. And I think that if we're going to do this, we have to find a way for this standard to not sort of make it so that our witnesses lose a tremendous amount of the creativity that they already have. So my basic thought on this, Drew, is if I got a vote on this, I would vote against it. And the reason is not because I don't think we should tighten our invention rules. I think we should. And I understand that what this might seem like an easier option to, instead of trying to come up with a new standard, we just sort of take a standard from a level where it supposedly works and import it here. Number one, I'm not actually convinced it works at the law school level. That's a separate thing. But number two, this is a different world. We need to come up with a way to tighten our invention rules while keeping the uniqueness of this competition and allowing students to be creative. I am very concerned that this rule is going to have unexpected consequences, and that if it is adopted this year for this upcoming season, the challenge of educating the community is going to be tremendous and significant.
So I just want to jump right at the last point that you said, Ben, because to me, that is the biggest issue with this. As they said, the reasonable inference standard is already not clear. If you're making a very, very considerable change, I mean, this is a, it may sound like it's one word, reasonable to necessary, but it has really big implications for what this standard is. And if teams do not get informed of it, if teams don't fully understand what it means or how big of a change it really is, I think it's really going to confuse a lot of people. I think it's going to result in teams not fully understanding how to best apply it. I think it's going to result in witnesses thinking that they are really, really restricted, and to a certain extent they are. And I do have a lot of the same concerns that you said, Ben. I will say that I think this is not a terrible overall idea to restrict reasonable inference or to make it more clear. I just don't think this is the way to do it. And I think that, as Ben pointed out, like, I'm really worried about how witnesses will interpret this and how limiting it is going to be for witnesses. The difference that Ben was talking about with law school mock trial and college mock trial, well, witnesses aren't scored in law school mock trial. So there is no incentive for them to try to be creative or try to be interesting. And I've seen law school mock trial witnesses. I've been a law school mock trial witness. It's dumb. You sit there, you say, yes, 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 no, no, no. You're not trying to do anything interesting. For the most part, a lot of the witnesses have their affidavits in front of them, and they're just making sure that everything they say is still consistent with that affidavit. There is no attempt to bring life to it. It's really boring. I did not enjoy it. I would not recommend people to start making their witnesses that way. But I also think that the idea of, okay, how can we not have these advocate witnesses that are, you know, cleverly working around the facts given in the affidavit to make it so that the attorneys have no possible way to cross-examine them effectively or to impeach them properly or, you know, whatever you want to go down. I get all of those things. I just don't know that this is quite the extreme measure we need to go to. And the reason why is that, honestly, the board and the folks that write the cases are not perfect. They do not write flawless witnesses that always make a ton of perfect sense if you only use what is necessary in their affidavits. Sometimes it makes a whole lot more sense, and it is completely consistent with the affidavit, to make a few reasonable inferences. And, you know, I get that the board, I guess, doesn't want that because it wouldn't, I don't know. I mean, maybe there's this idea that that's not fair, but to me, a team recognizing that and saying, oh, you know, it's really reasonable to understand, to use their example, that that means this person must have graduated in 4 years, or, oh, that it was in this particular field. And, you know, obviously the example that they gave of a doctorate is fairly minor and probably not going to be consequential on the case. But it's little things like that that witnesses use to build their character. And I don't want to take away from that for them. And I don't want to make it so that witnesses have to turn into law school mock trial witnesses. Because I see that really changing the activity in a very negative way. And I think that witnesses are an important role in mock trial, and I don't want to take away from them. But I do think that there should be measures, you know, to improve impeachment, because I agree that whether it's just difficult for most attorneys to pull off effectively, there's a huge time suck concern, and there's a general issue of just judges not always fully understanding why this impeachment just happened, or especially when a good witness is there, when they're trying to bait the impeachment because they know they're going to look good in it. Like, I think that's a problem. And to the rationale that AMTA gives, it's just not really an actual skill or something that is meaningful for us. I just don't ever think a real life witness is going to try to bait an impeachment. Like, that's not real, but it absolutely is something that people do in mock trial. So to that extent, I think that this is a problem, but I don't think this is the right solution to it. And I think that it is just a little bit too extreme for me. And that's, I think, my overall thought on it. But Ben, I'll toss it back to you if you have any more thoughts on it. Because I agree, this is probably the most controversial and the biggest overall change that this committee proposed.
Yeah, and you know, we focused most of this on witnesses for understandable reasons. But I think, like, I want to acknowledge that I think there are some things about this that could be really positive. My guess is the reasoning behind this proposal, if, you know, and of course, if people would talk about it in public, I wouldn't have to guess. But my guess is that the idea is, well, we keep seeing more invention sanctions. So clearly there's not a unanimous approach to how this works. And this will allow the board and you know, we'll talk about the new invention committee a little bit later on that's likely going to be formed. But this will allow them to say, no, this is the standard. It's clear. We all have a pretty universal understanding of it. And when it comes to, like, the details that you put into your case theories, I don't really have any problem with that. Forming a case theory at the law school level is not that different from forming a case theory at the undergrad level. Really, the only thing that's different is you don't spend a lot of time worrying about those bad apples, those few programs out there. And I'm obviously not going to name names at the undergrad level, but people who consistently and regularly will push the limits of what you think a reasonable inference is. We all know that people do that. I'm sure at some point, some programs, you know, including maybe mine at times, have done that. And so kind of getting rid of that would be a good thing. It would make life easier for the board. For me, what I would like to see is a standard that allows for, you know, sort of a necessary inference standard when you're talking about big picture things, but allowing some degree of leeway for reasonable inferences when talking about witnesses describing just everyday basic events. For example, right? If a witness says in their affidavit, it was dark and, you know, someone was following me, and that witness on the stand says that they were scared, obviously that's a reasonable inference if somebody is following you in the dark. I don't think that's a necessary inference because it doesn't say how that witness was feeling. Maybe, you know, maybe the necessary inference would be that witness loves being followed in the dark. Those little concerns could take away a lot of the creativity that we see in witnesses, or candidly, the example that's given in the explanation section of the rule saying that a witness can't say that they graduated in 4 years. Mm-hmm. I don't understand why we care about that.
Right.
Like, a necessary inference, you know, could, like, prohibit them from saying, yeah, I got my degree in X if it doesn't specify getting their degree in X or Y. And that could, you know, be material, which, of course, that's the hidden part of all of this, is it all comes back to materiality and what is material and what is not.
If they wanted to say, I got it in astrology and that's why I love all these astrological signs, and their testimony has nothing to do with that, I can't imagine a world where anyone considers that a material fact. That's clearly character building, and that would probably be fine. I don't know if you have a different opinion on that, Ben, but, like, that's my take on it.
Well, my first opinion is, if you're playing my team, please talk more about astrology, because then we'll win the trial more often. But I totally agree with that point. I keep seeing astrology witnesses and I'm like, do those score well? I don't think they ever score well, but that's a side point. My last thought on this topic is this. You know, we've had a lot of conversation about what the necessary inference standard means for our rules and how it impacts the community. And of course, it's easy to talk about why that shouldn't be the standard. It's a lot harder to say what should be the standard. And I tossed a few ideas out earlier, but I really do think it's a good thing that the Invention Ad Hoc Committee is proposing a specific standard. Because, of course, we can all sit around and complain about how the invention rules currently are, and deservedly so. They have a lot of issues. But good on this committee and good on the board at large for proposing something and kicking off this discussion and having this discussion. With that said, my biggest suggestion is, whatever standard we're going to do, or whatever standard we think we're going to do, it feels to me like the type of thing that needs to have community input, and it could be workshopped. For example, if AMTA were to reach out to me as host of the Charm City Classic and say, hey, Ben, in 2022, this is the standard that we think, you know, we've like provisionally passed this standard, but we'd like to gather some data on how it works and what impact it could have. Could you run your invitational with this standard as opposed to the reasonable inference standard? Cool. Absolutely. No problem. Happy to educate my teams and my judges. Probably wouldn't make that much of a big difference in terms of how the invitational is run. And then if there are any tab complaints, AMTA could gather feedback on that. Maybe they do that for like 5 invites or 10 invites or something so that we see how this works in action. But either way, I think it's a good thing that they're trying to figure out how to fix the rules. I just think that where we're at is not quite there. Drew, I know I had a lot of thoughts on just sort of how the rule exists and maybe some modifications to how it could be. What do you think about all that and how you think this rule could be applied?
So first of all, I will caution that while I do agree with almost everything you said, what you were just saying towards the end about, you know, if they contacted you as an invitational host and had you apply this rule, I think that the fear for me is that your interpretation of the rule and the board's interpretation of the rule may be very different. And I think that that's where so much of the confusion is caused, is when there are different people with different interpretations, and you might say, oh yeah, this is a problem, or yeah, this is a material fact, and someone on the board might say, oh no, it is or it isn't. So that's where I'll start with this. I think that my, you know, side of this, you know, we've been criticizing a lot, and I want to propose a solution. I think the solution that I kind of think is best is kind of a two-pronged thing. The first is that I think reasonable inference is good. I think that allowing a little bit of leeway for teams to come up with their version of how to connect the dots, whether it's not a straight line, but a squiggly line or a jagged line, I don't really have a problem with. I think it forces other teams to be on their toes. I think it allows for creativity to be more of an element. And I think that honestly, like when you're doing the same case over and over and over again, it gives a little bit of variation that kind of keeps this activity an exercise in adaptability rather than just an exercise in how much can you memorize all of this canned material, where you know exactly what the other side is able to do and say and think. And when we're so limited to that, we're just becoming little robots that just repeat the same thing over and over again. But when there's a little bit of variability, that really allows the truly great among us to shine and show that they're able to adapt based on these new circumstances, or that they're able to play you know, cleverly and manipulate the facts cleverly to help them. What I think we need to avoid, and what I think pretty much everyone will agree we need to avoid, are things that are case-breaking, things that are not resolvable within the universe that we have, or that the attempt to resolve them is not going to be either clear or coherent, or is going to result in a judge thinking that the, quote, witness has won and the attorney has lost, when the attorney had really no other choice. So, okay, what do I propose for how to do that? Well, again, keep the reasonable inference standard, and then basically you need to set out a rule that says, but you cannot, you know, reasonably infer, you may not attempt to infer something that either contradicts another fact or that, you know, has, that creates some sort of omission that that is, you know, almost independently unreasonable to have not left in there, which is a lot of reasonableness standards, which anyone that knows the law knows that our American justice system loves using a reasonableness standard. So I guess I'm kind of adopting that as well. But I think that one of the true solutions for this, and this is something that we're going to get to later, is that I think having a set of case law that you can go to and say, well, these were things that weren't okay, these are things that are okay, will kind of help with defining that reasonableness standard for us. Because I really think that the issue to me isn't in the standard itself, it is in the fact that no one knows how to apply it. I think that most people will agree that most teams' usage of this, most teams', you know, in my opinion, completely fair usage of this rule in the past, isn't really the problem. It's the extreme cases where they do something where people are like, well, that's not resolvable. That really breaks the case. It's unimpeachable, or it's causing some other problem. We don't want that to exist. And I think that the more cases that you can have where you can say, okay, well, this thing wasn't okay, but this thing was, that will really help teams a lot in understanding where that line really is. And I'll just add this. I think that that is a good exercise for all of us in learning how to be practicing attorneys. The honest truth of the real world is that things just aren't that black and white. Things live in the gray area. And while I do want us to do the best job we can to limit that gray area so teams don't end up getting sanctioned to high hell for something that they didn't intend to do, I also think that the way that we tend to resolve the gray area is through precedent, is through looking at past cases, past decisions, past rationales that have been given, and using that as an instrument and a lens to understand language such as what a reasonable person would interpret. So I think that's my overall takeaway from this. And, you know, I doubt that AMPTA is going to ever adopt what I'm saying. And we're going to learn from a motion that they've also basically encouraged and that is likely to pass, that was with a positive recommendation. It's unlikely that that precedent idea is going to happen, but it's my pipe dream. And in the spirit of, you know, talking about what I don't like, I want to also focus on what I think a potential solution could have been. So Ben, I'll give it back to you if you have any thoughts on what I just said, but if not, maybe we can start to move along just because this is getting a little bit long on just one motion.
Yeah. All I'll say is this. I think that the challenge, what you were saying, I think there's a lot of logic behind that from your competitive and coaching experience. Converting it into something that can have at least a somewhat uniform approach is where it gets really tough. And my guess is, and I'll see how the discussion goes, but my guess is that people will say that the potential detriments are outweighed by the benefit that a necessary inference standard is by its nature a little bit easier to understand because of its strictness.
It is. And I'll just say this really quickly, and then I do want to let you finish what you're saying and move us on. I just want to be clear. I agree. I think that the necessary inference rule is 100% much clearer than the reasonable inference standard. I just think that the necessary inference rule is so strict that it kind of just handcuffs a lot of witnesses and teams from doing what they've honestly become really good at doing. And a lot of teams have been really successful at utilizing reasonable inferences to build interesting case theories and interesting witnesses that most people, I at least hope, would agree are perfectly within the spirit and intention of the rules as they exist today. And I don't want to see us lose that and lose the ability to do that. And to your point, you know, I think those are really substantial goods. And I guess that to me, the outweighed by the confusion is cleared up by making really clear what our standards are and what it means for something to be a reasonable inference. And I don't know, I really don't see, I see the problem as being something that can be fixed in many ways other than tighten down the rules.
Yeah, I don't think I agree with that. I think that I'll put it this way. I agree with the sentiment that we shouldn't over tighten our rules, but I do think that what several years of history have now shown us since we've sort of entered what I'll call like the modern era of mock trial and mock trial inventions is that our current rules have so much leeway in them. You know, a couple of years ago, the CRC, I think it was the CRC, issued that invention of fact like memorandum. And I'll just be really honest, it was largely useless. It essentially clarified nothing and in some ways created more issues. And I think that was a lot of really smart people who got together and tried to do something helpful and mostly just ended up making things more confusing. I will say I totally 100% agree with you on the precedent point. I know we're going to get to that a little bit later, but on this notion that we should be guided in some ways by our previous decisions. But there are bad actors out there. We should not pretend that there are not people out there who take the looseness of the definition of reasonable inference and use it to create case theories that walk that line of case breaking, where they can plausibly say this didn't break the case because the other side didn't impeach, and the other side didn't impeach because they know that if they tried, the other team would just dance around the issue, the judges wouldn't understand it, and then AMTA wouldn't do anything about it. And if they did do something about it, it would be 2 months later, and it would be a punishment for the other team, and the team that was harmed by that case theory wouldn't get anything except, I don't know, the satisfaction that they got a team sanctioned or something. So, and I don't think that system's particularly effective, and I think it results in what we're having, which is these invention complaints, which happen and are adjudicated in the dark. And there's another motion which deals with that, which I think is really great, which we'll get to in a moment. So I guess all I'm saying is, I think the sentiment behind what you were saying is true, but I'm not convinced that we can, like, just kind of get together and think about our rules a little bit and clarify them a fair amount. I think we've tried that, and it's clear that we're still having some of the same problems. Some of those problems are problems that AMTA is creating, and some of the other motions will fix. But other ones, I think, do mean that we probably need to rein in a little bit some degree of what we call an invention.
And I'll just, I know I said last time I'd let you move on. I just want to note that I think that some of the other rules that they have added in are actually solving a lot of the problems that you're trying to address and that you're talking about. And that's, and we're going to get to those in just a second. I promise this is the last thing I'll say on this. But I actually think to what you just said, Ben, I actually really agree. And I think with all the other changes they're making, it kind of makes this rule less necessary. Ha ha ha, irony. To add, I think that you can maybe leave reasonable inference, do all these other things, and then say, hey, we're going to start releasing more cases. And by the way, it needs to not just be what you can't do, but hey, this was an example of something that was close, but we said was okay. I think that they need to do both sides so people can start kind of lessening that gray area and getting a better understanding of where the line actually exists and what they can and can't do. And the really, I promise, last thing about the bad actors you said, Ben, I think the number of them that are, I want to do this to make it so the other team can't possibly impeach. And if they do, they're going to look bad or what have you, that are trying to be case breaking without case breaking, I think is a really, really rare. I think that the more common case is someone that has, oh, I have this really clever idea, this cool thing I want to try. It's kind of me playing a little fast and loose with the facts in the affidavit, but it's not there. There's a little bit there. I think that the latter is the much more common offender of this rule, and I don't want to necessarily completely stifle students' abilities to try to play a little bit more interesting. And again, I just want to conclude by saying, like, we do the same case over and over and over again. It's very different from law school. Witnesses are scored. It's very different from law school. And I think we need to acknowledge those differences. If we don't want to just become law school mock trial where witnesses aren't scored, where witnesses aren't necessarily from your team, sometimes they're just random actors, like, it's a, and where we're not doing the same case the whole year, like, these are different circuits, and I don't necessarily think the same standard works in both cases.
I think, if anything, I mean, I think that a lot of what we're both saying makes sense, but obviously this is an area where there's going to be a lot of passionate discussion. For example, on the bad actors point, I pretty much disagree with that wholeheartedly, but I think that this is a good example of a point where, you know, two people involved in the community can have differing views. I'll be very interested to see how the AMTA board approaches this. I don't have a good sense, whereas I think a lot of these other motions will pass pretty easily. Mm-hmm. I don't have a good sense of how this one is going to go. I've chatted with a few people who will be there who feel similarly. So we will definitely be keeping an eye on that, and we'll be keeping people posted as the motions are voted on. So let's go ahead and move forward, and we're going to try to roll through the remaining invention motions, just because there's a lot of really interesting ones that we think we will agree are mm-hmm. pretty good. So invention 02 is a long one. We're not going to go through anywhere near the full list of what it does, but invention 02 deals with demonstratives. It sets out a ton of new procedures and replaces pretty much our entire section of the demonstrative portion of the rulebook, which, if you've read it before, was pretty vague and nonspecific. The main things that I think are sort of that stand out from this rule. So it gives a definition of demonstratives, which I think is largely in line with what we do. It loosens the electronic demonstrative rule just a tiny bit, and that you can't use electronic or light projected demonstratives, but you can use some small battery powered things like calculators or scales, which I think makes a lot of sense. Talks about how demonstratives can't add material facts to the case, the procedures for challenging demonstratives, can't enter them into evidence, still subject to the MRE, all that stuff. There's two things at the very end that I want to highlight on this that I think are the main things to discuss. The first one is there's a rule in this that if you have a demonstrative, the team bringing the demonstrative must use it first. I love that rule. I think that's a really good rule. I think it's largely how things operate in practice anyways, but it's a little, I won't say slimy, but we've been in a round or two where we show a demonstrative in captains and then the other team does something with it first. And it just kind of always felt weird. So I think for a competitive fairness, I'm good with that. The second thing I want to mention, and this is the thing that I think maybe we'll have some discussion on, is if you look at the comment underneath the part about not being allowed to introduce material facts, it talks about, for example, not being able to make up times that aren't in the case. Fantastic. We should be cracking down on that. Totally on board with that. But it says something, finally, if the expert's report does not contain a particular name for a method, for example, the CAT method or a particular component of that method. For example, to continue the previous example, tracing. No such words may be included in any demonstrative aid. Everything else in this rule, I think, largely makes sense. I don't have a problem with. I think just brings us in line with how things are already done. This is completely unnecessary. It goes beyond where our issues are. Our issues are not with people making up fake methods. Literally everybody does it. The overwhelming majority of the time, it has absolutely no impact on the trial itself. It's just a fun way to fill in a gap because these affidavits and reports are not written the way that a real expert report would necessarily be written. This, to me, is a solution to a problem that does not exist. And if that was taken out, I think I would wholeheartedly support every single change in this proposed rule.
Yeah. And again, this is a long one, and I really do encourage people that have the time to go ahead and take a look at it, because it is really changing a lot of the rules and understandings we had on demonstrative aids. But to Ben, to the point that Ben was just talking about this basically restriction on any necessary restriction on any inferences on the demonstrative aid itself. Basically, you cannot introduce anything on the demonstrative. And to me, like, it's the method, guys. Like, it's just so clearly not an issue. Like, I'm annoyed that they included that in the comment. I will note that that's not actually included as part of the official rule change. It's just in the comment. And so I wonder whether that's something where they may be able to say, hey, maybe the comment went too far. Maybe we can add in an exception that says for something that's immaterial, such as, or maybe it's not even immaterial, but for something like the acronym of a method, that's fine. Because, I mean, again, going back to this point about creativity, like, that's like the only thing the experts get to do that's kind of creative, usually. And if we're taking that away from them, I'm just kind of like, come on. Like, that's, I mean, it's just so little and small, but let them do that. The other thing I wanted to note, so I actually think I kind of disagree a little bit with Ben about this. I think it's a good idea not to allow numbers that don't appear to not be on there, or like time specifically. And like, I think I'm really, what I'm kind of thinking about is, Ben, I don't know if you ever encountered this, but I remember when people did the Ryder case. And this is the one with the whole, like the trails, and there was the map that had the key on it. And there were some people that took a little piece of string and they measured, you know, how far a mile was based on the key. And then they measured out how far things were. And they utilized those measurements as part of the what they testified to. And some teams, they did those measurements, but they also had it marked on their demonstrative, like how far that would be. So, you know, like whatever, 3, 5, however miles it was. And I'm using this because it's a recent example and it's one that comes to my mind. I thought that was clever. And I think that that should be okay. And it's the way that, to me, a map that has a key should be used. You should be able to blow that map up, measure things, and say, well, this is what, based on the key, based on what this map is, there's nothing new about that. But I kind of feel like people would say that if I added that the distance from this trail to this trail was, you know, 3 or 5 miles or whatever, and that's not in the case back, that they would say, well, that's an invention based on what we have here. And I don't know. I feel like I would be okay with that. And I think that that's a cool thing to do on your demonstrative. I think it's a clever way to utilize the case packet. And I personally don't see a problem with it. I think that, you know, that's to me part of the activity. You're using the materials that you were given. Maybe an older example, but one that I really remember people did was the Riley Winter case. And there was that exhibit that had a bunch of different statistics about every single, I think it was like all the different writers and like what place they were in or something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about, Ben?
Yeah, I remember.
Yeah, that exhibit, people know what I'm talking about if they did the Winter Case. A lot of people made graphs and other things based on that exhibit. And definitely not in the case packet in terms of the graph didn't exist there, but I don't have a problem with the team making a graph of that data and then utilizing that data to show, oh, you know, so-and-so is actually much better than we think they are at this. I don't think you can be misleading with that graph. And if you are, I think the other team should have every opportunity to, you know, argue that it's misleading and that it shouldn't be shown in the way that it is or whatever you might have. And I think you get interesting 403 arguments that are totally legitimate over an issue like that. So I know that I'm talking for a lot longer than I wanted to on this issue, but I just wanted to point out that I think that they might be overstepping a little tiny bit for me on the demonstrative aids. I really liked when teams got creative with it. Again, I definitely think it needs to be things that are actually in the file and in the packet. The example that they give, like if something just says an arbitrary, like, oh, and then later in the night, and you say, okay, well, that was at 10 o'clock. Like, no, definitely you should not be allowed to do that. But I didn't think a lot of teams were doing that, to be frank. And I just think that this is, again, kind of really hamstringing teams in ways that I don't know that I like, just in the spirit of making sure that everyone's on the same page. So that's kind of my thought on this rule.
Yeah, I don't read this rule as really being that restrictive, to be completely honest with you. I think that this rule largely codifies a practice that most teams already follow. For example, your graphs example, I don't read this rule as prohibiting that. I think if you take a graph that is just a visual representation of data that's contained within the case packet, you know, this just says demonstrative aids may not state or include any case specific material fact that is not included in the case packet. To me, that's a material fact that's included in the case packet. And I would even go so far as to say that the, you know, if a map is purported to be to scale and contains a key and you want to interpret that key, I think that's a material fact that's included in the case packet.
Well, it says, hold on, wait. I mean, so I guess to your point, you're saying if the case packet does not contain a specific number or a precise description on how to calculate it, so your argument would be that is a precise description about how to calculate it. Okay. I mean, sure. So I hear what you're saying, and I guess that my point then maybe is just if what I was saying is all still fair play, then AMPTA, I think just maybe make sure that is clear. And maybe it is, and maybe I'm just reading into things, but I guess that I got worried about the idea that you cannot have any case-specific material fact that's not included in the case packet from the perspective of, going back to the rider example, if they never said, you know, so-and-so lake is 5 miles away from this point, then you can't have that on your demo. But I think that they should be able to. So I guess that's what I'm saying that I want to make sure that we preserve.
Yeah, and that's a really good example of what could be a gray area. And we'll get to the advisory opinions rule in a little while. To me, that's a good example of something where AMTA could issue an advisory opinion that says, you know, if you interpret the key, you interpret the key, or maybe they provide that information because of a new standard. But either way, I think the vast majority of the stuff in the demonstrative rule is good. I appreciate AMTA going through and trying to get a little bit more specific, because I will say, I do think that there are teams out there who are pushing the limits, particularly on when a time is a little bit ambiguous, and they sometimes will attribute a little bit more specificity to a time. I do see that occasionally, and I'm glad to see that there's some degree of clarity on that.
But take out the thing about methods, please. That's that. Come on. We can leave that.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I really see why that needs to be in here. So, all right. So moving us forward to Invention 03. This one is a motion to replace one of the rules dealing with improper invention on cross-examination. I'm not going to read the whole rule, but essentially, you know, I think we're all familiar with the fact that on cross, a witness does not commit a violation if they testify to material facts not included in their affidavit if they're responding to a question. So if you ask a question, you know, if you ask the question and you open the door, you got to deal with the answer. But it specifically says an answer is not responsive if it volunteers information on the same general subject, but doesn't respond to the specific content. The example they give in the comment is a witness who says in their affidavit, I need glasses to see distant objects and I wasn't wearing them. And then they're asked, you weren't wearing glasses on the night in question. And the witness says, no, I was wearing contacts, but their affidavit doesn't say anything about them wearing contacts. I've been a bit surprised. I've heard some people who have been a little bit upset by this. To me, this feels really non-controversial. I could be wrong. I think people who are bothered by this rule are misinterpreting it a little bit. To me, what this rule is just saying, it's not saying witnesses can't fight. It's not saying witnesses can't add information that is in their affidavit, or as we all call it in practice, see if you can slip that in on cross-examination, because we don't have a hearsay exception for it. I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and I don't think this rule touches that at all. It just says, if the witness asks you a cross question, and it asks you a specific question, and the answer is contained in your affidavit, you can't try to use the fact that you can invent on cross when you're being responsive to a bad question to then turn around and invent on cross being responsive to a good question. I don't have any problem with this rule. I think this rule is fine and pretty much is in line with exactly how things happen already.
Yeah, I actually agree. I think that this rule is good. It's important. And to the point that I made earlier, I think this actually solves a lot of the concerns people have had in the past about the reasonable inference standard. And I'll just add that to me, I think that the example they give about glasses and contacts is a really good one. And I encourage people to read through it and make sure they understand what it's saying. Because the important clarification is that in the affidavit, it said that they were not wearing glasses on the night in question. And then they were asked, you were not wearing glasses on the night in question. The fact that that is what was in the affidavit, we're very clearly trying to get at that point. To me, it is important that the witness responds, no, I didn't. Again, to me, this is about, like, in real life, the reason why we have this is that in real life, if that person was actually wearing contacts, they would have wrote that in their affidavit, guys. Like, come on. Like, and as a judge, I was always bothered by this. You adding in, oh, no, but I was doing this other thing that makes it make complete sense. Why didn't you put that in your affidavit? And the problem is that when someone tries to impeach on it, it gets all jarbled because it's like, well, no, I didn't know that I needed to put every single clothing that I put on and all my daily routine in my affidavit. Sorry, that's what I'm here to explain today. They do something like that and the judge is like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Why are you impeaching them on that? That's so weird. So I get it. And I think that this is a great example. I think it's a good rule to add. And again, I just think that this actually solves a lot of the concerns that people might have had about the reasonable inference rule and the concerns that they mentioned, in fact, that they had before.
Yeah, I think that for the most part, this rule just kind of talks about something that most people are already doing. I don't see it as particularly controversial, but it will allow in those rare instances where somebody pushes the limit, especially on cross, I think it will give teams, you know, the ability to have, you know, a specific rule to point to.
Yep.
Okay, so talking about Invention 04, this is an interesting one that I think we'll largely agree on, but it's just a thing that's been coming up more and more, and it's dealing with guilty portrayals. The specific rule says to prevent guilty portrayals by witnesses who are not the defendant, a defense team may not allege that a witness called by the defense may have committed the crime or wrong at issue, or otherwise suggest that a witness called by the defense is an alternate suspect in the crime or wrong. And then to determine if a team violated this rule, AMTA will consider the witness's testimony and performance, as well as the team's statements and conduct throughout trial. And then just going through a little bit of the rationale, it says it's become increasingly common for defense witnesses to portray themselves as guilty, undermines the educational value and fairness of trial, because the attorney does not develop transferable direct examination skills by pretending to confront or control a teammate who is actually trying to make themselves look guilty. In short, I think this is a good rule. We should have done this years ago. Obviously, there was a fairly high-profile example of this a couple years ago, but that high-profile example and the repercussions of that example, many people said that you would see less of that. You've seen more. Mm-hmm. You see it on a pretty routine basis now. In addition to it just being silly and weird and looks kind of ridiculous, I totally agree with the point that it kind of breaks the activity and serves no educational benefit. So I'm 100% on board with this rule. I think it's a good one. I got no issues with it.
I'll keep it brief. I actually totally agree. I think this is really changing the activity. I think it's changing the way teams are going to approach how they design defense theories. I think this means that AMP needs to be very careful about writing cases and giving other alternate suspects that aren't just the defense witnesses, because let's be real, there have been times when they have done that, and it's been a bit of a problem, in my opinion, where the only way to get certain facts in is if you call that witness, but then you're stuck because apparently, according to this rule, you can't then claim that they're guilty. So I think that this is a good rule. I think AMP just needs to be aware of it when they write their cases to make it so the defenses still can argue a potential alt suspect without having it be one of their own witnesses. Because I agree with what you said, Ben. I agree with the rationale. It just defeats the purpose of the activity.
Yep. And I think the case writing point is such a good one. It applies to tons of these rules that, you know, we have such great case authors, but if we make some of these changes or all of these changes, case authors very much need to keep them in mind when writing. Invention 05, I think, is going to be a real quick discussion. This one just codifies that witnesses are not permitted to recant statements in their affidavits, nor may they attempt to indicate through their portrayal that statements are not true, even if, you know, they say they're true, but try to pretend that they're not.
Yep.
Seems pretty common sense to me. Drew, anything on this
one? Nope, just keep the ball rolling. We're falling behind anyway. We can keep going to six.
Yeah, I think I think five and six kind of, or four and five kind of go together.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll kind of cover six and seven together because they're largely covering the same thing. Six is a motion by the invention committee to create a competition integrity committee, which will consist of five or four more individuals appointed by the president, and it will replace the CRC, the Competition Response Committee, in having primary responsibility for issues involving invention of fact. Invention 07 disbands the CRC and pretty much transfers all of their responsibilities to the CIC, with the exception of a few small things which can go to other places. My read of this rule is twofold. It specifically mentions that the CRC, which the CRC, for those who haven't read through, by its nature, it has some executive committee members on it, the president's on it. It's a lot of really busy people. And it says the CRC is composed of some of AMPTA's busiest people, including some whose responsibilities have nothing to do with invention and don't even require familiarity with the case. The CIC, I think, would be more of a hearing board, would be more of a committee whose specific job is to make sure that inventions are adjudicated as fairly as possible and would be made up entirely of people who have a pretty intricate understanding of the case. In a vacuum, I don't have any issue with this. The CRC has a lot of work, and I think at times I've heard reports of the CRC feeling a bit overwhelmed with the amount of invention complaints and the amount of work that each one entails. So to have a committee that's specifically dedicated to that and has people who hopefully will be experts and will be as neutral as possible, I don't see any concerns that I have with this. Drew, anything that stands out to you about six or seven?
No, I think that this is all good things. I think it's good to kind of separate these powers a little bit. Obviously, there's always sort of some overlap, and I will still, we don't need to get into the amount of transparency we wish there was behind what all these committees do. But my understanding is that prior to this, the CRC was kind of playing a bit of a judge, jury, and executioner role, as well as writers of the rules and I said judge, jury, and executioner. I really meant that they were kind of the legislators, the executors, and the judges, and kind of all three houses of the American government all rolled into one single CRC. And that was just kind of dangerous because you had them interpreting their rules and enforcing their rules the way that they saw fit. So I like that we're kind of separating it out and saying the rules committee is going to handle rules, TAC committee is going to handle TAC things, and this committee is going to deal with inventions and, you know, other things of that nature. So I like that, and I like that it's going to be a specialized committee on this issue. And I just in general think that spreading out the powers within the board is probably a good thing. So I think that overall this is good, and I think that, not a whole lot more that needs to be discussed with it.
Yeah, and I think when we get down to the last one, to 11, we'll talk a little bit about maybe the oversized role that the CRC has played in some ways and some of the criticism of that. But I agree, and I think that I have full faith in Jonathan Woodward to put together a committee that will be fair and do a good job in this new role that I think will likely occur. So we've talked about a couple rules that we really like. I'm guessing that INV08 is going to be one of those. I'm not going to actually drop in like a, you know, a
party
noise
sound.
Of, like, right. Or
yay,
something like
that.
Yeah,
we did it. We're here.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Like, ladies and gentlemen, we got them.
Right.
So Invention 08 says that for the 22-23 season, the CIC, which is what we were just discussing, must create an advisory opinion process for properly registered programs to submit questions about the permissibility of certain testimony. I love this rule. I'm right. So glad it's been proposed. I desperately hope it passes. It says all advisory opinions must be published to the AMTA community, and the submission of a request for an advisory opinion will constitute consenting for sharing anything with the community. This is a good thing. It is a good rule. Obviously, there's some small questions about how it would work and precedent, which we're going to talk about in a bit, but just nothing but praise for this. I really hope that this passes because I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is, to me, just phenomenal. One small nitpicky thing that I noted that I, you know, just from the perspective of us writing rules properly, they referred that this is going to be the CIC is creating these things, and they a couple times said the CRC is not required to do whatever CR, and I think they meant the CIC. So just to make sure people reading it aren't confused, you know, I hope that they do edit that, because I think that was a mistake. Could have been, I think they said the CRC is going to be dissolved, so I don't know how CRCs also can respond to stuff. But yeah, I think this is great. I remember when they sent out that, the memorandum that you're talking about, Ben, and I think that accompanying with that, maybe it was the next year or something like that, they said explicitly that they were going to not do this. They said they were not going to allow people to ask them questions. And I remember being like, what the hell? Like, why? Like, it's just, it felt so the just opposite of what everyone wanted and needed at the time. And this is them finally saying, oh, you know what? Maybe we should let people ask us questions, because then maybe they wouldn't end up getting into trouble for it later. So I'm so glad they're doing this. The only thing that I wish they changed about it, aside from editing CRC to CIC, is I wish this wasn't just for the one season. I really think they should just make this a standing thing. I think every season, I think they should do it from, like, I don't know, like the fall invite season, and you know, you can limit it. You don't have to answer every single one of them. But to me, this is something where every year people are going to have a new question. Okay, based on this case, based on the readings of our rules and how they apply to these facts, well, how are we going to see it differently? And I just think, give people the opportunity. If you don't want to answer all of them, don't answer all of them, but at least give people the chance. And I hope you come damn close to. And I'll say this, if AMTA feels truly overwhelmed by the amount of submissions that they're getting, you know, whether it's the student advisory board, whether they want to set up a separate group, I will volunteer to comb through those and find a couple of good examples that we give to the CIC and that they give us decisions on. There are a number of solutions they can have, but I will just say that I think saying, oh, too many, throw up our hands, we're not going to do this anymore, or oh, we're only doing it for the 1 year, to me is weak, and it is not that it is them not doing enough. If you want to be strict about this stuff, you have to give advisory opinions. And I love this rule so much, but I just want us to keep it every single year instead of just next year.
I'm trying to think of two people who would be less likely to get a call from AMTA right. to asking for help with picking inventions.
But if they did it, I would say yes. In a heartbeat, I would say yes, because this is so important to me. And this is just, look, it's just, we need to do that. And if they think they're overwhelmed by it, I would do it.
A little bit of inside baseball, though. My guess is, I haven't talked to anybody in this, but my guess is they're doing, like, this is similar to the scouting rule, where it's just as a one-year thing to see how it goes. And if it goes smoothly and everybody's good with it, I'm sure it'll get extended. So I totally agree with what you were saying about how they should do it. But my hope is that, and I think most likely the reason they're doing that is just to not overcommit, and then if it doesn't go the way they were hoping, having to go back and repeal it the following year and stuff like that. So either way, I think it's fantastic. I agree with everything you're saying. I'm really excited to hopefully see it in action. All right, so INV09. This is a really interesting one, in part because this issue was recently discussed. So it's adding rule 9.1A regarding reporting a rule violation at a tournament. It says, for the 2022-2023 season, the CIC will investigate allegations of invention of fact during the national championship tournament and, where appropriate, issue penalties. The committee need not be physically present in order to do that. In-tournament investigations and penalties require participation from at least two committee members. Committee members are not disqualified by serving as an AMTA rep. The rationale says in-tournament review, if possible, is preferable to post-tournament review. If it's possible anywhere, it's at NCT, where we have the most staffing and where many of the people likely to be appointed to the CIC are present. This is a pilot program to see if in-tournament review can work. My very brief thoughts on this. I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. It may have been in Cincinnati in 2019, or it's possible it was last year, but I know it was in an in-person meeting. There was a motion that was proposed dealing with this exact topic, dealing with in-tournament review. I actually think it was last year in Denver, now that I'm thinking about it. And there was a lot of really great discussion on it. I remember we talked about it on the podcast. And the conclusion was just logistically, it's nearly impossible for a lot of reasons. I'm skeptical of this, but I don't have a problem with trying it at the 2023 NCT as long as there are some pretty strict rules and some clear communication on how exactly this is going to work, and also contingent on the composition of the CIC. Because if the CIC is made up of 4 out of 5 people who have programs at NCT, mm-hmm. and they're also out there trying to adjudicate, I mean, we can't have that. That gets into a mess that absolutely would not be acceptable. So candidly, I think the conclusion is going to be that in-tournament review is impossible. I just think, given the time frame that our tournaments happen on, I do not think it is possible, and I think it's going to be something that we determine isn't really going to work. But this narrow path towards that, I think I'm okay with giving it a try, because I agree with the sentiment that, yeah, it would be better if we could solve these problems quickly. I'm just not sure if we can.
I'll tell you that, to me, the only way that this actually works is you need to have, you know, a member, at least one, who, as you said, does not have another team going in literally every round. So they are watching it. And then as something happens, they can say, you know, hold up, let me go talk to the judges, explain what just happened, whatever ruling they decide, they do it, move forward. To me, that's the only form of in-tournament review that would work viably. The issue to me is that the fact-finding required of, okay, what exactly did this person say? Okay, what is the other side claiming they said? Like, you're just going to get into this, like, whole he said, she said right in the moment. Like, passions are high. And the other thing about in-tournament review is that, God, don't you, I mean, can't you already see that what's going to happen is someone's going to have a tied ballot, or they're going to lose a ballot by one, and they're going to say, oh, well, this happened in the round. Like, I think you guys should overturn this ballot, or I think we should get 2 points. Like, to your point before, Ben, there's a huge problem with the sanctions process, that when a team breaks the rules, the team that got kind of screwed by it has little to no recourse, and they're kind of in this position where their only recourse is to punish the other team. And that's not ideal. But the problem is that when you start saying, well, we can just in the middle of a tournament say, oh, just kidding, so-and-so actually won this, you're going to double, triple, like quintuple the number of teams that are all of a sudden going to find something that someone did that they think is a sanction and that they think is a problem, because it might mean the difference in them getting another point on a ballot. So I think there's some concerns with it for sure. I think that as it's currently proposed, I have some concerns with it. I don't think it's necessarily viable for them to get someone in every single room, but I don't know. I'm kind of inclined to agree with you. I don't think that in-tournament review is necessarily possible. And I just, I don't know. I have definitely some concerns about this one, more so than I think a lot of the ones that we've just been talking about.
Yeah. And I think practically speaking, I don't think it would be, you know, in round type of thing. I think it would be, you know, after rounds 1 and 3, when you have a full overnight, a team submits a complaint, they submit their film along with the complaint, because almost everybody films at nationals, and then the CIC takes a look at it. But even that, I think all of the same concerns you're identifying, you know, yeah, look, if I'm in a round and a team does something I think is over the line, but maybe not egregiously so, and we lose a ballot by 1 point, I'm a coach who's competitive. I would certainly be tempted to file a complaint in that, you know, in that situation, if I thought it was even borderline meritorious, because maybe that results in a ballot getting flipped at nationals, which is a huge thing, both for your positioning at nationals and your ranking and all that stuff. So I am cautiously okay with trying this, but I think that, you know, going back to what something you said earlier, Drew, before we move us to our last few, my hope is that if we get better at a lot of these rules, the need for this will go away.
Right.
Where if we're doing a better job of adjudicating our own competitions, you know, this is trying to solve a problem that nobody likes with a solution that I think most people understand is probably impossible. We can't just pause and stop and like go through everything. So I'm pretty skeptical this is ever going to work, but we'll see.
I'll just quickly say that like the reason why I think the only way to do it is in round is that I really do not believe in AMCTA arbitrarily going in at the end and saying, well, if this had happened, the judge would have scored this differently. Or, oh, you know, we're going to just completely invalidate this ballot or this direct exam or whatever because something happened in it. To me, the best solution is a completely neutral third party pulls the judges aside, says, hey, this team just did this thing that they're not actually supposed to do. Please reflect that in your ballots. You know, like, let the judges decide. And at the end of the day, it's an activity where the judges can place as much or as little weight on that as they so choose. We will get later on to where we might be able to learn a little bit more about our judges. But until then, you just got to deal with what the judges want. And I think that that to me is the best form of review if we could have one. What you proposed about after rounds 1 and 3, sure, I guess it has potential to work, but I would like to see it in a system then where teams don't necessarily know their result yet when they make the complaint. I would like to see teams bring the complaint before they actually get their results, which might be the way that they're intending on doing it. But I just, the exact example that you gave, Ben, I just see literally every team that loses a ballot by one coming up with something, saying, oh, look at this one thing that they did that, you know, oh, that was, I don't know. And especially with this new necessary inference rule, well, it's not explicit that that's the only way it could have been done. I just, I don't know. I think it's going to give them a lot more trouble than it's worth.
Yeah. And I actually agree with all that. I don't think that from a schedule perspective, it's, you know, and like you said, a logistics perspective of having 24 people, obviously that's not really possible either. So it's just, yeah, it's something I'll be interested to hear the debate on this. I wouldn't be shocked if this motion doesn't pass just because this issue came up recently and it didn't, but we shall see. So we got two more invention motions to discuss. Each of them have some interesting things, and then we'll wrap up by going through a few of the other motions that are proposed or one or two of that have been tabled. So invention 10 is a motion dealing with interpretation of rules. And it says, if AMCTA publishes any interpretation of its rules, whether related to sanctions, invention of fact, or anything else, such interpretations shall not be considered precedent for future seasons.
Can you add in the little groan sound right now in the edit, please?
I'll do my best. Thus, in future seasons, teams and students are not deemed on notice of such interpretations unless they have been codified in the rule book. So I want to read the rationale here really quick. And then, Drew, I know you have some thoughts on this. So the rationale says students should be able to find all our rules in one place, the rule book. It is unfair to expect students to search memoranda from past seasons to discover and understand our rules. There may be times where AMCTA wishes to publish rulings to avoid repeat violations during a particular season, but if we want future students to be on notice of those rulings, we should update the rulebook accordingly. my very short thought on this is I think that this has a decent idea behind it. We should put all our rules in one place. Totally agree. 100% on board with that. And then takes it to a logical extreme.
Right.
We shouldn't apply precedent. I don't even really understand how one connects to the other, to be completely honest with you. It's confusing to me if it means in-season precedent doesn't apply, such that like one violation wouldn't consist as precedent if somebody does the exact same violation. That doesn't make any sense to me. So this rule doesn't seem particularly well-crafted. I'm not a big fan of it. Drew, what are your thoughts here?
All right. I'm going to explain that I think there is a pessimistic view and an optimistic view of what this rule means. I'm going to start with the optimistic view. The optimistic view of this is that they're saying, whenever we make a decision, we're going to codify it in our rule book. That way you know where it is and it all becomes very clear. And we're not going to have any precedent because once a decision is made, it becomes a rule. That would be great if that's what they're saying. I would not be upset if that's what they were saying. The problem is that I think I'm a little bit more of a pessimist. And I think that the actual interpretation of this is that they're saying that when they make a decision, they are not bound by that decision. They do not have to make the same decision again. They don't have to apply the facts of a previous decision to the facts of a current case. And the problem with that is that that means that if I hear that so-and-so got, you know, their invention over, you know, not sanctioned when they did X thing, I might say, oh, so it sounds like I'm allowed to do X thing. And then whoop-de-doo, all of a sudden I get sanctioned for that. And I'm like, what the heck? I thought you said that that was fine to do. The other version of this is that a team does that. It gets sanctioned. Another team then sees someone do something similar to it, says, hey, that's sanctioned. You're not allowed to do that. Brings it to the board, and the board says, no, actually, this time it's fine. That wasn't precedent. That was just that specific case. That sucks. I get what they're saying. I get that they want to put everything in the same place. If so, then every single decision that they make about a case should be added to the rules so that it can be precedent. If you do not have precedent, then what are we talking about? Like, how can we ever expect anyone to understand what you mean? Like, they are then asking students to read the minds of the people that are going to then make decisions. And furthermore, they're saying just because we did something in the past doesn't mean we're going to do it in the future. And I apologize, I don't mean for this to get political, but goddammit, does this feel like our Supreme Court right now? And it is infuriating to me. So I am very heated about this. I am irate, frankly, at the state of our U.S. system, and I do not like seeing that we are sort of teetering on this similar flimsiness with precedent. I think precedent is really important. It should be deeply respected and should only be overturned for very specific reasons. And this is literally just saying we're doing away with it. So I'm a bit heated.
I'll say this. I totally understand why this rule as it is written right now produces that response, because we're all searching for guidance, right? We're all looking for ways to make sure that we stay on the right side of the rules. And while I understand this isn't written, but I think part of the concern with this rule is, well, last year's case and this year's case are different, so it's hard to apply things we did last year to things we did this year. Fine, fair enough. I think the advisory opinion process could also help with a lot of this, but I would suggest that AMTA take another crack at this and try to find a way for precedent to play a role, such that if you are accused of a sanction, you can go back and look through different sanction rulings and be able to say, hey, you all have allowed this or prohibited this in the past. Here's why we think it is applicable. It doesn't have to be controlling precedent, but it can play a role in the conversation, in the way you were discussing where, you know, this is a community that prides itself on legal analysis. And I think that it could play a role there. So bottom line is, I agree with the notion that rules should be communicated clearly and that people shouldn't be expected to be held to understand rules that are not presented to them in a way that they would know where to find. But this rule isn't it. It doesn't do that. And I think that this one really needs to go back to the drawing board.
And just to really quickly wrap up a few things on this, Ben, you talked about the memorandum
that was written on Invention of Fact a while ago. That did not help me at all. What helped me a ton was when AMTA published a few previous cases where they said, this is what someone did. This is why it was a sink. This is why it got sanctioned. This is our problem with it. And yep. even if sometimes I disagreed with them, like those were really helpful in me understanding, okay, this is what AMTA views as a sanctionable invention. This is what I should not do. It is just really perplexing to me why they would do away with that. And I think that what you said is exactly why. They don't want people to go back through and look at past cases and try to litigate things with them. They just want to be the ironclad, we decide things and you deal with it. They don't want to have to argue with students about, well, in the past you said this and that's pretty similar to this. They don't want to deal with it. They just want to decide things and say, well, we have no precedent, so you just have to deal with our decision. And that's weak. And I just think that I will be really, really upset if they codify this. And it will be very, very jarring. And I don't know. I really hope that you're right. And I hope they go back to the drawing board with it. I hope that my optimistic view is right and that they're just going to do that. But I don't really think that's what they meant.
Yeah, I'm really genuinely not sure. But I think unlike most of the other rules, this one to me doesn't feel like it makes a whole lot of sense. So let's move to our very last invention, our ad hoc invention committee rule. And this is invention 11. The last rule fired you up a little bit. This one, I think, may fire us both a little bit, So this one is specifically dealing with penalties for invention of fact. Most of this rule is fine. It goes through the penalty structure, gives an order of severity, verbal or written warning, point deductions, forfeiture of ballots, probation, loss of bids. It says in rare cases, generally limited to repeated or flagrant violations, penalties may include suspension of an individual team or program. Fine. Most of that is fine. It does deal with mid-tournament review, which we've already talked about and had some concerns about. But I want to focus on the last item of this, which is the appeals process. I think that most of this is pretty logical and codifies some of what has already been practiced. But the appeals process says verbal or written warnings may not be appealed. Penalties of point deduction on ballots, ballot forfeiture, probation, loss of bids, or suspension may be appealed to the executive committee and will be reviewed under an abuse of discretion standard. Suspensions may be appealed to the AMTA board of directors. The appellate decision of those bodies regarding penalties is final. Yeah, so I don't buy that. First of all, having a decision that can't be appealed is always a mistake. Having a body, even if it is a body as well thought as I'm sure the CIC will be, having no one look at their decisions and treating a verbal or written warning as if it's not significant is bizarre. Of course it's significant. It can serve, you know, if you have a verbal or written warning that you don't think is fair and you appeal it and you can't appeal it and then you get another one, you're going to be looked at even more so, and you didn't really get due process on that. An abuse of discretion standard to the executive committee is not an appeal process at all. The likelihood that the executive committee will find that their friends and colleagues abuse their discretion is essentially zero. And so I guess this appeal process just feels really weak to me. It feels like not much of an appeal process at all. And I'll just briefly mention that there were a couple of motions submitted that are tabled. It's EC01 and EC02. We're not going to get into detail, but I would encourage people to read them, that set out a different framework for appeals that I think has much more comprehensive process. So bottom line is most of this rule is fine, but the appeals process part reads to me like an attempt to prevent or limit appeals as much as possible. And to me, that's not how this should work.
And let's be clear, that's exactly what it is. They are tired of people appealing them. They're tired of people questioning their decisions. And this is their way of being like, oh, well, now we just, you know, screw you. We do what we want. And I apologize for being curt, but it is just so emblematic to me that the two motions that got tabled that specifically deal with this, that deal with really, in my opinion, pressing needs that AMTA needs to talk about when they deal with sanctions, got tabled, and this one got positively recommended. look, the rest of this is fine. Like, it's codifying things that we pretty much already understood. You know, fine, okay, they're laying out those sanctions, that's fine. But the appeals process is really important. And again, like, if we want this to be at all an example of what, you know, due process is in the real world and outside of mock trial and give us practice for that, like, this is a joke. And you're exactly right, Ben, that, like, the idea that you can't appeal a verbal or written warning, like, I just don't understand why they say that. Like, look, I get that appeals practically never win because you're appealing to a group that contains the people that made your decision. Like, yeah, they're probably going to side with their friends and themselves over you and your appeal. Something I really quickly wanted to point out in the tabled motion, basically it's a subsection that discusses the idea that as part of the appeals process, they would want to codify allowing the appellant to actually speak. That to me, like, needs to happen, like, really desperately needs to happen. It's pretty disgusting to me that we have an appeals process that effectively silences the person bringing that appeal. What we currently have as a system is when you don't like a decision that was made sanctioning you, then you can say, hi, could you please revisit it? And, you know, I don't really know why you decided this because you haven't, you know, they have, sometimes they'll give some description of it, but, you know, I don't really know what some people, there's never a dissenting opinion that gives you some idea of what some people thought were okay things that you had done. You're just given, this is our decision. And then you can appeal that and say, well, here's where I disagree with your rationale. And then the people that decided that then go to the rest of the board of directors and say, okay, here's what we decided before they appealed on these grounds. What do you guys think? Oh, and by the way, they still get a vote. So yeah, if you're thinking to yourself, that doesn't seem very fair, I'm inclined to agree with you. And the tabled motion wanted to deal with that and make changes to that. And this process is trying to restrict it even more. So definitely, I hope AMCTA spends some time actually talking about this. I would, you know, bet everything I know that they're not going to address this very much, and they're just going to try to pass it and pretend it's, like, you know, just the normal course of business. And it's really upsetting. And I think that it's a huge problem. And, you know, maybe at another time we can talk more about this, Ben. But I think that the appeals process is one of the biggest jokes in AMCTA, and it's really sad.
Yeah, I wouldn't go as far as I think you would on some of those topics, but I would generally agree with the sentiment that the dealing specifically with this motion, the appeals process that's laid out in this motion, to me feels like, and I think this is an area where I would agree with you, sort of an attempt to avoid appeals or to disincentivize appeals, which is just not, if we're trying to set an example of judicial fairness, the way that we should do things. And I will say that much of what we're, like, let's be very candid, much of what we're talking about here is a combination of speculation and behind closed doors conversations that people have. Mm-hmm. You and I have both had those types of conversations because this process is deliberately so shrouded in mystery. I've spoken to people who are involved in sanctions complaints, even people who weren't sanctioned, who were afraid to even talk about it. Mm-hmm. And that should not be the case, irrespective of whether you agree or disagree with how AMCTA handles sanctions. It shouldn't be this scary, uncertain process where people are afraid to talk about it only in whispers. And we end up in the situation where there's a lack of trust amongst part of the community with the process. So a lot of this rule is fine. I hope that the appeals process is revisited and some of the ideas in the tabled motions and other ideas are adopted to make it more of a fair and also just an honest process for everyone involved.
And I'll just say before we move on that to all of our listeners, and especially to any of the board members that might be listening, I apologize for the fact that I'm very heated and upset about this. I just want us to be better. And to me, when I see motions get tabled that I think are really trying to solve these problems, and instead we positively recommend one like this, it's just really disheartening and really frustrating. And especially because I know that the people that are affected by this, again, don't really get a voice and don't really get a vote in these things. It just feels very frustrating. And it feels like people are very, it feels like the people that are being affected are powerless to the people making the decisions. And I want better for our community than that.
Yeah. And I'll be very clear. I don't think you have anything to apologize for. Like, this is a passionate subject. People are passionate about this. You know, we've had major, major examples of invention of fact having serious repercussions. And I know at that, you know, that example and with other example, there have been allegations that AMTA's appeals process is unfair, some of which I think have significant merit. So this is a topic that we need to be discussing, that we need to be open and honest about, as we're revisiting a lot of these rules in a way that hopefully will prevent most of this from ever needing to come into play, except in rare circumstances. So those are the 11 invention motions. We're pretty much done. We're going to highlight just one or two other little things here that we think are worth noting. And as we've said before, you definitely should go and read the board meeting agenda yourself. It's a little confusing, but I think for the most part, you know, it's relatively able to follow. So one or two other things. So the Diversity and Inclusion Committee has a motion adding a gender and pronouns form to the captain's meeting and to the case. I think that's fantastic. I hope that they're getting input from people, you know, people who use non-binary pronouns or people who would maybe specifically be applicable on that form. I hope that they're getting that type of input in a way that will allow that form to be comprehensive and useful to the judges, and that that form is used by all invitationals. This is just sort of a stray thought that I'm thinking of as I talk about this. If AMTA puts that form in the case, they should make it a condition of their IP rules that you have to use that form so that you don't have invitationals ignoring that form, which I think is really important. There's another one about a procedure for co-hosting NCT and the host bid for co-hosts. I think that's great. I know AMTA struggles getting hosts for NCT, and so to incentivize people to co-host is great. And then the last one that I'll highlight, and then Drew, I know there's one you want to highlight before we wrap up, is Rules 02, which eliminates the sunset provision for the no scouting rule, no scouting in rounds 1 and 2 at Orcs and Nationals that was passed a couple of years ago. We could spend some time discussing this. I think it's largely a waste of our time. This rule is going to pass. I have seen some implications of this rule that I don't particularly love, including a team who wanted to learn, not being able to travel to a particular Orcs because it was thought that maybe they would be not allowed to watch rounds 1 and 2. And I think we've talked about the possible implications. This is largely set in. I don't love it, but it's pretty much become part of it. And I think this will pass easily. So Drew, I think you had another one that you wanted to highlight before we wrap this episode up.
Yes. So for anyone that has been trying to follow along on the actual board meeting agenda, you'll notice that there's one of the different basically motions that are listed. They're all listed in green, except for one that's in blue. And this is because this one was advanced with no recommendation. All the other ones that we've discussed so far were all advanced with a positive recommendation. Effectively, positive recommendation means the committee that made it said, we really like this and want it. And no recommendation means that, you know, it wasn't advanced with a positive or a negative, just with none. So this one is specifically TAC-01, and it's to create a TAC innovation program where basically invitational hosts can try out new things for AMTA, and they would submit a proposal for a new, you know, whatever system they're going to try, and AMTA would basically waive some of the invitational fees in order for them to do it. I just wanted to note that I think this is a really cool idea, and I hope that they do end up passing it. I think it's just a cool way to, you know, we've discussed so much the idea of having invitationals, having AMTA use the invitationals more, having them use them as testing grounds for things. And this is exactly that. And again, it's just like, I don't know why we wouldn't do that. Like, I just think it's a great idea, and it's a good little nugget of an incentive for teams to try new things at invitationals, to try things out. That way AMPTA doesn't have to do the testing ground at their tournaments that are the ones that matter. So I was a little disappointed that it's no recommendation, but I'm optimistic. Going to try to be an optimist for the rest of the episode, that maybe this gets off the no recommendation and into the books.
Yeah, I'm really glad you pointed this one out. This was proposed by Andy Hogan, who's going to be, I don't know when the official transition is, but he's taking over as TAC chair. He was vice chair last year. Andy, I know him pretty well, talked to him a fair amount. I think he has some really good ideas about the future of this organization. And I am 100% on board with this as someone who hosts an invitational and would totally be on board with trying something interesting, whether it's electronic scoring or a variety of different things, just to kind of give AMPTA some information. I love, for example, the language in here saying that the Orcs pairing system could have been experimented with at an invitational. I think that's a great example of something that could be interesting to try, or could have been interesting to try. So yeah, I love this. The more innovation, the better. You know, it's as Andy puts in the motion, it essentially costs nothing, maybe a couple hundred bucks in tournament fees or given tournaments ballots or something. So yeah, I totally agree with this. And I think that it is an example of smart thinking and trying to think about the future of our organization.
I don't really know why it didn't get a recommendation. It's just, it's hard for me to understand what someone was like, oh, bad idea, guys. Like, didn't like this one. Loved the appeals process, not this one.
My guess would be, to sort of put in just a little bit of informed speculation, TAC, in my experience, tends to be a little bit more conservative of the committees because of, you know, like, I don't know if there's any West Wing fans out there, but like TAC plays with live ammo. Like, when they make a decision, it impacts everyone. Whereas like, you know, some of these other committees, they make decisions, they kind of filter through, they might have a small impact, but TAC, you know, they do really, really important things. So something like this, my guess is most people like, they just want to make sure that they know exactly how it's going to work.
No, I think that's true.
Well, Drew, we've gone through a lot of stuff. I think my last point that I'll make is there are a ton of tabled motions that we do not have the time to get through that you guys should definitely go and read. Friend of the pod, Ian Lampert, through board member Elizabeth Smiley of UCLA, submitted a ton of fascinating proposals. There's one at the very end related to doing Vaudeer of the judges in the national final round.
So fun.
We both think is super cool. You should go read it. Now former or past president Brandon Harper submitted a proposal, which was tabled, to be clear, to reduce our time limits on direct and cross from 25 to 20. I would recommend going and reading that and just making sure that you're informed on all of the different ideas that are coming up in the board meeting. So Drew, I am looking forward in just a couple of days to getting out to sunny San Diego and reporting live from the board meeting. And I hope that everyone who's listening gives our Patreon and our Discord a chance so that they can have an opportunity to get some live updates while we're out there. Anything else that you think we should talk about before we finish up this very ambitious episode?
Just really quickly wanted to note one. I got to say, I don't remember the last time I saw a motion that was really from a student. I think there may have been one or two. I almost want to think that Elizabeth Bays submitted one at one point through someone, but Rhea Lakaraju submitted a motion that is now tabled that was Development 02. It was through Will Warhey, and it's basically to create a alumni engagement committee. And I just wanted to note it as a tabled motion that I really would have been behind. I'm really excited about it. I've said it before. I really think we need to do more for our alumni engagement, do more to just keep us involved and helping out with the community, whether it's judging, being an AMPTA rep, what have you. They get our emails and then do nothing with it. And that aggravates me. So I was glad to see someone that has already done so much for our community show that she does not want to go out quietly and wants to keep doing stuff for us. So thank you, Rhea, and thanks, Will, for bringing that up for her. But definitely sad to see that one get tabled. I hope that they reconsider that one as well.
Yeah, I don't have any inside information on this, but I wouldn't be shocked to see that as a motion that maybe mm-hmm. would get referred to committee to try to flesh out exactly how it would look. But I think it's a good idea and something that a lot of people would be interested in being a part of. And maybe someone like Rhea, who's about to graduate, could be tasked to help lead a committee like that, given that the more we engage our most recent alumni, the better the organization gets.
Couldn't think of anyone better to do it. And I guess the thing I will wrap us up with, Ben, is that, you know, we discussed the Patreon and the Discord. If I have said things that you agreed with, that you disagreed with, you know where's a great place to come and talk with me about it and disagree with me or agree with me about it?
Let me guess. Mock trial confessions.
Oh, God, please no. Come join the Discord. I would love and welcome the discussion. Ben will be posting updates from the board meeting. I will be commenting my wildest optimist and my wildest pessimistic thoughts about it all. And I hope you guys can join me for it because it should be a lot of fun.
Couldn't agree with that more. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We know this was a long episode, but there's a lot to talk about and a lot of really interesting subjects to go through. So we hope that this was a useful and informative overview. And hey, if you've been stuck in traffic for the last hour and a half, we're happy to keep you company. Thank you, as always, for listening. We're going to be in your feeds again very soon. We got Trial by Combat to talk about, the Rookie Rumble to talk about, a board meeting review to talk about after it happens. So we're going to be doing all of that and more very soon. Until then, this has been The Mock Review with Ben and Drew.